Well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is someone that many of us already know, actually, for the Turkish Endeavor entrepreneurs who've already had the pleasure to be with him in person. It's Seth Godin. If you just go on Google and search Seth, you'll get all about Seth Godin. May we all grow up to have one word names in Google search. Seth is an extraordinary entrepreneur, but he not only, recreated the field of permission marketing, not only asked the question, does advertising actually work? But he is also not only the founder of two companies, Yeri Dunn and Twitter, but the author of 18 books. A lot, four of them were done on Kickstarter. And we all have read many of them. We all knew he had tribes, we didn't know they had a name until we read him. We all knew there were issues with the Icarus deception. We all have learned now that we're not only crazy, as I say we are, but we're also weird. And he is someone who made both purple cows and yellow glasses. Cool? And more than that, he is an extraordinary person. We talked earlier today about values, about living a meaningful and integrated life, about going home. And he's not just an extraordinary entrepreneur and author, but Seth Godin is an extraordinary human being. And I want to thank him for being here and bringing him on stage.
You're awesome. You're awesome. Thank you, guys. Thank you. We're just going to... thanks a lot. So for about 9 years, I played the clarinet. And that's actually not true. For about 9 years, I took clarinet lessons. And I went dutifully to the lessons, and I showed up and did what I was told. But when I was probably 15 years old, I went to see the Buffalo Philharmonic with Michael Tilson Thomas, and they were performing Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin. And Rhapsody in Blue starts with a clarinet solo, and the first note is one of the easiest notes to play. And as I sat there listening to this talented musician play his solo, I realized that I had never once played the clarinet. That never once in all my years of showing up and following the instructions had I actually played even a single note that was anywhere near the note that this man was playing. And I've thought long and hard about how that all fits together. Why didn't, at one point, someone say to me, you know, that's not what it's supposed to sound like? Why was it that they are always so eager to teach you more notes and more fingerings and more songs? Why is it that there's this idea of let's plant more seeds in more places and not, could you just play one note that's worth listening to? Just once. Just once. And I think the reason I never did was because I didn't care enough. I didn't care enough to put in the effort. I didn't care enough to put in the pain. I didn't care enough to show up with my whole self to play even one note that was worth playing. And underlying all that was the thought that I wasn't nearly brave enough. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Is bravery and our misunderstanding of what bravery is and what bravery might be able to become. So two places to start. 10 miles from here toward the Hudson River is a White House on Route 9, and it was the house of Madam C.J. Walker, first female self-made millionaire in the United States. She also happened to be the first black millionaire in the United States. C.J. Walker invented the entire idea of franchised beauty shops long before there was a McDonald's. And 50 years after C.J. Walker, a guy named Audie Murphy, who was a sharecropper's son, went to fight in World War II and became the most decorated soldier in memory. He was such an extraordinary, brave hero that he played himself in the movies and lived a life recreating those glory days. And when we think about C.J. Walker, a black woman taking herself up from nothing, and we think about Audie Murphy putting everything he owned, his life, on the line for his country, it's very easy to come to the conclusion that brave is for other people. That other people are brave when they do something that's maybe in their genes or maybe the situation warrants. But brave isn't necessarily for us. And I want to undo that. Each of you is here today because you've already done things that most other people can't even conceive of. Most other people think you are doing things that are way too risky. Entrepreneurs know that's not true. Entrepreneurs know we take very few risks because we do things that we are aware of that we can control. And so we are very calculated in how we do things. But other people think we're the brave ones. So let's take a couple minutes to think about what does it even mean to be brave in a post-industrial world. We're right next door to the golf course here. And golf, I hope we can agree, is the single worst spectator sport there is. And if you want me to show you what I mean, let's just try this. Give me the wimpiest, weaseliest, worst golf applause you can muster, quietly if you could. Go ahead. That's terrible. Excellent. Could you double it? Thank you. Double it again. Thank you. Double one more time. Fabulous. Okay, stop. That's what we do for a living. That's what we do for a living now. What we do for a living now is we don't insist that people who aren't interested start making noise. What we do is we find people who are disconnected and have a little interest, and we amplify it. And we connect them. And once we connect them, we reinforce that tribal feeling and have them do it again, but maybe a little bit louder. And we try to create that groundswell of support. So I'm going to give you five or six elements of bravery. And the first one I'm going to start with is this idea of connection. Scott Harrison, who started Charity Water, has raised $250 million to help the poorest people on earth have a chance for a healthy life. What Scott Harrison did before he did that was he was a nightclub promoter and a novice drug addict. He was working his way up into the lifestyle of fancy cars and fancy apartments. And one day he realized that he had lost all connection with his youth and with his parents and what he used to stand for. And instead of just whining about it, he got on a boat and he went to Liberia, where he was a photojournalist for a charity that brings doctors to people who have never seen a doctor before. And he chronicled what was going on. He connected with the people on the ground. He connected with people who needed to be seen as humans. And that was a brave act. Then Scott came back and he connected to the people who used to be coming to his parties, who used to be his customers when he was a nightclub promoter. And by building that bridge, by connecting, in a post-industrial world, in a world where we don't need to work in a factory anymore, Scott has been able to do something that most people couldn't conceive of. He has taken these brave acts, not the brave acts of a sports star who the sportscaster says, boy, that was brave using a 7-iron when everyone else used a 9-iron. This is the bravery of doing something personal, the bravery of being able to look other people in the eye and say, I see you. I understand who you are and what you do. I read this morning that the CFO of Twitter is now in charge of their marketing efforts. And I also read that he doesn't tweet. And that's a really fascinating place to be, because who are you connecting with? Some of you have businesses where you make a thing that you would never buy yourself, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. The question is, are you able to connect with the person who is buying them? They used to, the people who made legs pantyhose in this country were all men, right? Men don't need to wear pantyhose as far as I know. Are you able to connect? Are you brave enough to put your psyche out there, your mindset out there, in a way that makes it personal, not just about moving basis points and cash and investment from one place to another? Okay, the next word I want to share with you about bravery is obsession. And this is about my late friend Lionel Poulin. So my wife has transportation narcolepsy, which is a fictional disease she got shortly after we got married. And it causes her to fall asleep in any moving vehicle, unless there's a good movie on the plane. That's how I know it's fictional. So we used to have two little kids. They're not little anymore, but we still have kids. And we planned a trip to France, and we missed a flight, and we missed a connection. And for 17 hours, we were traveling. And for 17 hours, my wife was asleep. And for 17 hours, my kids were making a ruckus. And we're almost at our destination in rural France, and we're driving through this pasture, beautiful, scenic farm on the side. And I notice from the back seat, it's finally quiet. And I look in the rearview mirror, figuring my kids are finally asleep after 17 hours of being annoying. They're not asleep. They're staring out the window, transfixed by a cow for about 3 seconds. And then they went back to making a ruckus, because cows are boring. And if you've seen one cow, five cows, 10 cows, they're all the same. But what if it had been a purple cow out the window? If it had been a purple cow, I would have stopped the car. My wife would have woken up. What's going on? She would have gotten out the camera to take pictures of the cow. I would have gotten on the phone, called my friends back home to tell them I was looking at a cow. And my kids would have ignored me as usual, jumped out of the car, run across the street, jumped over the fence, and rubbed the side of the cow. So that when they went to show and tell in 2 weeks, they could tell people they had seen and touched a purple cow. Because a purple cow is remarkable. Remarkable means worth making a remark about. And no one is going to talk about an ordinary cow. No one is going to talk about your business just because it's important to you. No one's going to talk about your project or your nonprofit or the work you do just because it's important to you. They will talk about it if it's worth talking about. And so we get to obsession. Lionel Poulain was the most famous baker in Paris, which is a very big statement to make. 60% of all the restaurants in Paris, 2- and 3-star restaurants, served his bread at lunch and dinner. Lionel had the largest collection of bread cookbooks in the world. I used to go there to spend the day with him. We would walk into a restaurant and people would go out of their way to address Lionel. Lionel made a loaf of bread like no other. He refused to make baguettes. He made a bread that redefined what it meant to make bread. Now, if you talk to him about politics, he would have nothing to say. He was obsessed about this, and it took a form of bravery for him to say, I know I could make chocolate, but I'm not going to. I know I could do this, but I'm not going to. I know I could spend time on that, but I'm not going to, because that would make me into a wandering generality, as opposed to a meaningful specific. The third word I want to share with you about bravery is the word tension. Now, tension is something we are taught to avoid. We are taught that when there's a silence, we should fill it. We are taught that when someone is uncomfortable, we should make them more comfortable. But tension is the ugly sister of change. And we cannot make change without causing tension to happen. And so we can't flee from tension. We can't pretend tension doesn't exist, because if we do that, we will also be hiding from change. We will also be turning our back on the very thing we are trying to do. In 1955, Ella Fitzgerald, great American jazz singer, went with Illinois Jacquette and a few other musicians to Houston to put on a concert. The reason she was doing it was to create tension. It was an integrated audience and an integrated group of musicians on stage. She wanted to bring this message to Texas. Backstage, in her dressing room, between the first show and the second show, 5 Houston police officers broke in and arrested her and the rest of the people in the cast. And the reason they did it, ostensibly, was because they were rolling dice in the dressing room. You know the real reason. They did it to humiliate them. They did it because the tension was too much for them to bear. Well, they went to the booking, they got bailed out, and they made it back in time for the second show. When people talked to Ella Fitzgerald about why this had happened, why she was willing to do it, she had nothing at all to say. Because she wasn't going to change things by talking about it, she was going to change things by doing something, by caring enough, by being brave enough to create tension in the world, and realizing that she couldn't possibly please everyone. Okay, In this industrial world we live in, though, post-industrial, it's very easy to get hung up on what we used to do. Ellen Langer talks about the idea that all of us carry a bowl, and entrepreneurs have a really big bowl, with a bunch of frogs in it. And that what seems like we're trying to do is keep the frogs from jumping out of the bowl. That we have to spend all our time looking at all the frogs, making sure that all the frogs are in the right place, moving this way, keeping the frogs from jumping out of the bowl. But if we're going to be that way, we can never be mindful about our work. We can never pay appropriate attention to what it really means to be brave. That if a frog wants to jump out of the bowl, we let the frog jump out of the bowl. Because we can't possibly please everybody. We can't possibly eliminate all the alternative choices so that every frog is happy at all times. We are here to make change. That change that we are making is our job. The emotional labor of living with the tension becomes vitally important. Quick little experiment here. If you don't mind, raise your right hand as high as you can. Thank you. Now raise it higher. What's that about? Everybody has trouble with that. You can put your hands down now. Everybody has trouble with that. We hold a little bit back. We hold a little bit back because if we don't, the board is going to ask for more. Because if we don't, the boss is going to ask for more. Because if we don't, the teacher or the coach is going to ask for more. The entire model of the industrial mindset is hold a little bit back because there's a relationship between the boss or the system and you, and it's always going to try to suck everything it can from you. The alternative, though, is the way the artist feels. The artist understands she's all in. She has to be all in because you can't be human and doing that artistic endeavor, whatever it is, running a company, running a nonprofit, starting something, connecting with people, creating tension, all of those things require us to be all in. And so we have to figure out how to undo all of this thinking we've had about bravery and what it means to do the important work. So I mentioned art and artists, so let me describe what I mean. I don't mean painting, I mean art. Jackson Pollock was one of the greatest artists who worked in paint of the last century. What you might not know is that Jackson Pollock had a brother. His brother was named Charles Pollock. Charles Pollock was a painter. You never heard of Charles Pollock. The reason you never heard of Charles Pollock is because he was a painter, not an artist. They both had the same teacher, Thomas Hart Benton. Charles Pollock painted just like Thomas Hart Benton did. If you couldn't afford a Thomas Hart Benton painting, you could just buy a copy from Charles Pollock. That's not art, that's just painting. Marcel Duchamp installed a urinal into an art exhibit in 1917. He caused a riot, that was art. The second person to install a urinal in an art exhibit was a plumber. And that's the decision that each of us has to make when we think about what it means to be brave, when we think about what it means to do this work. Do we want to be the person who goes in first and might be criticized, the person who goes all in, the person who brings their true self, or do we just want to be a painter? Do we just want to be a plumber? And that's the challenge of being an entrepreneur. The challenge of being an entrepreneur is there is no manual. That's the challenge of running a nonprofit. Here's the thing about nonprofits. If the problem was easy to solve, we would have solved it already. If we knew how to solve the problem, we would have solved it already. The people who donate money to nonprofits aren't giving money to nonprofits so they'll do what they did yesterday. They're giving money to nonprofits so they will fail on the way to doing it in a way that works. I've lost my water. Here we go. Nope, this is Ken's water. Do you know where they went? Here we go. Look at this. Thank you so much. Sorry.
Doers here.
Sorry about that. I don't want doers, I want water, but thank you. Okay. Now, we didn't practice that, did we? The obvious response to most of what I've talked about so far is it's too soon. I would love to launch this innovation. I would love to take my organization to the next level. I would love to do these hires or to open that office, but it's too soon. I will wait till the market is ready. Well, here's the thing. 500 years ago, when Gutenberg launched the printing press, 93% of the people in Europe were illiterate. And many of them needed reading glasses, which hadn't been invented yet. These are bad times to launch the book. Because it takes years and years to learn how to read a book. Why don't you launch it after everyone knows how to read? Then you'll sell more books. There were no bookstores either, but that's a whole other conversation. When Carl Benz invented the car, it was against the law to drive a car in Germany. He needed a letter from the king to be able to test his own invention. Not only that, there were no roads or gas stations in Germany. This was a really dumb time to launch the car. You should have waited. And Linda mentioned before Steve Case. When Steve Case launched AOL, the fastest you could get online was 1,200 baud. Right? For those of you too young to know what that means, imagine an ice pick hitting you in the head over and over and over again. They should have waited for DSL before they launched AOL, and then everyone could have gone on and it would have been much easier. Here's the thing. It's always too soon to do this important work that you seek to do. Always. That the only time it's important, the only time it's art, is when some people say it's crazy. When some people say it's not going to work. There's a jazz club in Boston that I really encourage anyone here to go to if you ever go to Boston, called Wally's. And it's really inexpensive and it's really tiny and it's in the basement. And there's an open mic jam session every single night from 6 p.m. to midnight. So you get there, there's 20 people sitting, and you see the three or four guys standing waiting to go on. The three or four people who are standing waiting to go on, the quartet, some of whom we've not met before that night, they're not doing it for the money because they're not getting paid. They're not doing it to be famous because they're never going to be famous. They're doing it because in that moment they can share their art. They can do their thing. They can be present. They can be human. They can be brave. They do not play their greatest hits because they don't have greatest hits. They play what is in their heart in that moment, and that is what the audience needs from them. So when we think about what it could be for us to be brave, I want to encourage you to think about two Japanese words. The first one is wabi-sabi, and the second one is kamiwaza. Wabi-sabi is what we call it when something is handmade, when it is a little bit worn, when it is not quite perfect. Wabi-sabi is the way your favorite jeans are. Wabi-sabi is the feeling of using wooden chopsticks instead of metal ones. Wabi-sabi says, a human made this, and time has touched it. And we don't have to apologize for either of those things. So when we show up to talk to our board, or we show up to talk to our customers, if we come with a big bushel basket of apologies about how we will be perfect tomorrow, we're not being human. We're not making art. We're just trying to be industrialists again. But that's not the opportunity for the people here. That's not the opportunity for your market. That's not the opportunity for your project. The opportunity is to say, it's good. A catcher's mitt that's been a little bit worn is better than a brand new catcher's mitt. A human being helped you with this problem. Here is my spreadsheet, and there's a question mark in it because I don't know what goes in that square. Which leads to the second word, kamiwaza. Kamiwaza is the Japanese word for godlike, myth-like, the way the gods would do it. And the astonishing irony of it is the way you use it in a sentence is when you describe a human being being human. So I read it first in a New York Times article about a track meet, and they said that the runner was running with kamiwaza. He was running full out without thinking about it, about what his appointments were that afternoon or whether he was going to win the race. He was just present, full out, human, godlike. And so when we think about being a CEO, the answer is not how do I do it more like Ken or Linda or Seth. The answer is how do I do it more like me? How do I bring more of me to this thing? How do I say to people, I made this? Not deniability. I made this. We made this. This is real. What do you think? And some people are going to look at it and say, I don't like it. And we need to say thank you. Not argue with them, not dismiss them, thank you. But then we can go to you and say, what do you think? And what do you think? Because we are not making something for everyone. Everyone is gone. Everyone has left the building. The center of the curve, the normal distribution, not there. Or if they are there, they're not listening to you. Normal people do not have a problem that you can solve. It's the people on the edges, the weird people, the people who have chosen to have a problem. Those people will listen to you. But they will not listen to you if you're sitting there cowering in the corner, wondering if you're going to please everyone. No, we have to think about this a different way. We are not trying to win a prize. Years and years ago, I was a struggling freelancer slash entrepreneur, and I made a video, and it got nominated for an American Film Institute Award, which is sort of like an Academy Award, but not at all. And so I rented a tux, and I flew out to California for the big ceremony. Bruce Jenner was there, it's true. Kathy Rigby was one of the presenters. And we're all in this room with these big round tables, and I was in a category, Best Children's Entertainment Video, and we were a lock to win. The only other serious contender was a sock puppet named Lamb Chop. And so they said, da, 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 the category is, and the winner is, and I start standing up, and Lamb Chop won. I was beaten by a sock puppet. The amount of pain I felt was significant. But the thing is, if I hadn't been nominated and I hadn't flown to California and someone had come up to me on the street the next day and said, did you hear that Lamb Chop won? I was like, I don't care. The reason that I cared was I had become fixated on that kind of winning, on getting picked, on having an authority say to me, yes, good job. As opposed to doing what I've tried to do every day since then, which is say, am I proud of this work? And if Bruce Jenner doesn't get the joke and Lamb Chop wins, that's fine. Because it wasn't for them. It wasn't for them. It's for you, because I made this. Now, back to another kind of bravery. And that's this idea of the bravery of giving direction. Until recently, in the United States, 4 million dogs and cats were killed every year. 4 million healthy dogs and cats killed within 24 hours of being taken off the streets. They were killed by the SPCA and the Humane Society. It was their job. In their charter, that's why the towns and cities supported them. They were the dog catchers and the exterminators. They killed dogs and cats. My friend Nathan Winograd went to work for the SPCA of San Francisco. He was not in charge. He had no budget. He had no authority. He went to the city council of San Francisco to get the charter changed. And humane societies from around the country flew to California to testify against him, saying it would unfairly raise hopes. He left in defeat and instead went to the people of San Francisco. But not all the people of San Francisco, just the weird ones. Not all the weird ones, just the ones who cared about this issue. And that's where he brought the bravery of direction. He said to them, I think we can solve this problem. And within 100 days, he had enough donations and he had enough volunteers that San Francisco became the first no-kill shelter in the United States. Not one healthy dog or cat has been killed since that day in San Francisco. And you say, well, that's easy. It's San Francisco. Well, he left San Francisco and went to Tompkins County, New York, and he did it again. And then he went to Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and he did it again. And then he went to Reno, Nevada, and he did it again. And now there are 500 cities around the globe where this happens. Because one person said, follow me. One person brought the bravery of direction. Did he know it was going to work? Of course not, right? The same way C.J. Walker didn't know it was going to work. He did it because he cared. He did it because he could bring himself to the table and say, I think we could do this. Which leads to our friend Linda and our mutual friend Jacqueline Novogratz, and another word that is inherent in what it means to be brave and is missing from almost all entrepreneurs' vocabulary, which is the idea of compassion. The compassion of being able to deal with someone who doesn't get it. The compassion of being able to look someone in the eye who doesn't have what they need yet and figure out how to get them what they need. That when we can bring compassion and direction and tension and obsession to the world, when we can create these networks of connection, then we are being our best and brave selves. That I have argued that you need to be remarkable, but where I'm headed with this is that we need to be unreasonable. That it's only when we do things that other people think are unreasonable that we are truly being brave. And a lot of us hesitate to say that we're the ones who can do that. Every 3 years, there's a conference of physicists called the Solvay Conference, named after a physicist from many years ago. In 1929, it was the best Solvay Conference ever. Madame Curie was there. Albert Einstein was there. Niels Bohr was there. It's said that Heisenberg was there, but it's uncertain. What we know is that there are 17... I'm so thrilled that you guys understood that. There are 17 physicists. There are 29 physicists at this event. 17 of them won the Nobel Prize in Physics after the event was held. You didn't get invited to Solvay because you won the Nobel Prize. You won the Nobel Prize because you got invited to Solvay. And so the magic of Endeavor, the real magic of what's happening here is this. Endeavor works hard to find people who are going to succeed, but as often as not, people succeed because they are here. Because to your left and to your right are people as brave as you who need your reinforcement and your support. That you may think in any given moment that you are the weakest or the dumbest or the slowest or the least competent person in a circle, but everyone feels that way. That the bravery that we need to bring to the table is a different kind of bravery than Audie Murphy had. It is the bravery of being the fifth hammer, of being willing to be a little out of tune, of willing to speak up, willing to connect, willing to look people in the eye and see them for who they are. To create tension where tension needs to be created, and to bring compassion and connection when that is what is most deeply needed. So I want to finish, and then I'm going to take some questions, with a couple stories. The first one is something to think about. Since I began speaking, in fact, in the last 12 seconds, somewhere on Earth, a baby was born. And I wonder what would happen if we were in some sort of science fiction novel and she was the last one. No other babies ever born for some interstellar space-time rift continuum reason. How would we treat that last baby? When she was 3 or 4, would we say, well, this is the best preschool we have for you because we can't afford a better one? When she was 6 or 7, would we send her to school and say, we know your teacher doesn't care, but we've created such a bureaucracy around your teacher that she's forbidden to care and be original, but just stick it out, because when you're 15 or 16, you will take the SAT, and this is the best test we can think of because we have so many people to judge, right? At what point would we say to this last kid, well, actually, we care about you? Because the last baby scenario, I'm pretty sure, is never going to happen. But what about the customer who just visited your website, or the person who just called your office, or the person who walked into your store? Are we going to say to that person, well, yes, we treat everybody equally poorly because we're very busy? Are we going to say to that person, well, you have to fill out this form because we don't have the time to talk to you like a human being? Well, in fact, she might be the last customer. There might be no one in line behind her, because we're not bringing enough humanity and the bravery that's required to do that to the table. Less than 3 miles from here is one of the banes of my existence, the White Plains Airport. And the White Plains Airport used to have a flight to Boston, and I hated that flight. And the reason is because you can drive to Boston if there's no traffic in 3 hours and 26 minutes. And I used to have an office there. And if I drove, I would always hit traffic. And I would look up overhead and see those planes landing, and I'd curse the fact that I hadn't flown. But if I flew, there'd be some sort of air traffic control disaster, and I'd look down below and I'd see all those cars and I'd curse thinking I should have driven. They don't have that flight anymore, I'm pleased to say. But the last time I took the flight, I won the lottery, and it was 28 minutes door-to-door. This is before 9/11. 28 minutes, I get to my destination. But I get punished on the way home, and we circle the White Plains Airport 9:30 at night till we run out of gas, and then we have to make an emergency landing in Albany, New York. Now, many of you are from another continent. Let me just say, think of the worst town you'd want to spend the night in, Albany, New York. So there I am in Albany, New York. It's 10 o'clock at night. Pilot comes on, and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're on the ground in Albany, New York." Yeah, I knew that part. "And we'll be here for 2 hours, then I think I'll be able to fly the plane back to White Plains." I'm like, this is ridiculous. So I open my laptop, and I go online. I have one of those early modems. I go online. Avis has one car left, a four-door. I grab it. They close in 5 minutes. I put my luggage away. I stand up on the plane, and I turn to the audience. Everyone's an audience to me. I turn to the passengers. I say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a psychopath. I am wearing a tie." I was wearing a tie. "I am wearing a tie. My car is in White Plains. I think yours is too. It's only an hour and 20 minute drive. Who wants a ride home? I've already paid for the car." No one raised their hand. As far as I know, they're still in Albany. And I spent the whole ride home thinking, was it my presentation? Was it my tie? What did I say? Why didn't they come along? And just before I got to my car, I realized what the problem was. We grew up in a culture, this is a culture all around the world, not just the United States. We grew up in a culture where if you stay on the plane, it's United Airlines' fault. And if you get off the plane, it's your fault. And those people decided it was easier to stay on the plane. Here's the thing. Everyone in this room is already successful. But as my friend Shalene says, that's not the question. The question is, do you want to matter? I hope you will. Thank you for your attention. So we have about 7 minutes for questions. If anyone has one, I would love to take on whatever you want to talk about, tactical, theoretical, or otherwise.
What are you playing guard in?
Here's the thing. I've only told the clarinet story once before. Some people have trouble dealing with the tension of me putting the clarinet together and then not playing it. But the tension was the entire point, because I don't care enough about the clarinet to put the time in to be able to play a note that's worth playing. And I never did. And part of me is sad that I'm not able to do that, but part of me acknowledges that I'd be better off being really good at something else than being mediocre at this. So I don't know if I'm ever going to play the clarinet. There you are. Hi.
Not a question, but basically a compliment, because you basically inspired me to become an entrepreneur. So
thank you.
For that. I was in a workshop at your place in 2004. After that, I started my entrepreneurial career.
That's so fabulous. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. What else we got? Linda, you may have to vamp here. Oh, there we go. Hi. Saving the day.
I'm Laura Maido. This ever and fast-changing world, what's your advice to continuously be brave? It seems that we're always bombarded with so much information, and so how do you maintain that? And then also, what's your advice for our kids?
Okay, so I'll answer the second question first, and then I'm going to have you fill me in a little bit on the first one. I wrote an ebook for anyone who has kids or kids called Stop Stealing Dreams. And I'm thrilled 4 million people have read it so far. I hope you'll go to stopstealingdreams.com. Basically what I'm arguing is free. But what I'm arguing is we invented school to give industrialists a steady supply of employees who do what they are told. That's what public school was invented for, and private school is that way too. Do what you're told, sit in straight rows, say back what I just told you. But anything worth memorizing is now worth looking up. That we don't need people to be bodies of disconnected facts, because Wikipedia is that. What we need are people who do two things: lead and solve interesting problems. And that's it. So what I tried to do with my kids is raise free-range kids who are constantly solving problems that haven't been solved before. That your 10-year-old ought to be blogging, and your 12-year-old ought to be editing Wikipedia, and your 14-year-old ought to be arguing with you at the dinner table about world policy. Because it's that idea of forming an opinion and defending it that creates the kind of human beings that are valued going forward. Not, I got a 97 on my AP English test, and now I, because we don't use a number two pencil at work. We don't go to work to fill in the little circles. That's not a job, right? So we need to be able to create an environment where kids will fail and fail and fail again on the path to learning how to be resilient. Your first question said, how do we keep up with all the information? Was that it?
You mentioned to be brave and to be an artist is to constantly be in touch with who you are, right?
Yes.
So with this ever-changing world and, you know, at the same time having to evolve, how do you balance?
Right. So here's the thing. The media complex wants you to evolve in lockstep with everybody else, because the people who make stuff want everyone to buy the same thing. That's not the kind of evolution I'm proposing. That we need to evolve in our own way in a direction that's about where we want to take our work. And we need to insulate ourselves from what the competition is doing and insulate ourselves from what the big organizations want us to do if it's a distraction from the core of our work. So if you want to be a writer, don't busy take notes on what Random House is publishing these days, because if you just bring Random House more of what they're currently publishing, they're not going to publish it anyway, right? That the whole idea of being crazy is not that you're crazy, it's that the other people don't get the joke yet, and that you have to refine your work so that when they do get the joke, it's something you were proud that you made in the first place. So we don't need to spend more time reading blogs and more time trying to figure out what everyone else is saying. So you see, for example, all these corporations trying to get on Twitter, because that's what all their corporations are doing, even though it's off mission, it's off target, it's not what they're here to do. So I would encourage everyone to ask themselves a very simple question: what is it for? This thing I'm doing, what is it for? And if something comes up that distracts you from that, it doesn't matter. What matters is being obsessed at that four, at who you are serving and the change you are trying to make in what they do. Thank you. Time for a couple more. Yes, sir. Rodrigo.
You, in your books, you defend you create the permission market, and now we are living in a world of content market that I think it's pretty much the same, but with a new expression and everything. What we are seeing is that almost everyone is starting to do content market, permission market. What is going to be the next step so you can be remarkable again?
Okay, so let's be really clear here. Permission marketing and, I'll argue, content marketing are self-limiting in the following way. If you already know what you need to know about something, the other content doesn't matter to you. If you're already given permission to American Express, as I have, I'm not looking for another charge card because I solved my charge card problem. So that's why being early and consistent and real is so important. If you are the source, you stay the source until you blow it. Because most people you care about aren't busy browsing. They just want their problem solved. So the way we become remarkable here going forward is not, I have your permission, but I don't have hers, I better go yell at her. It's, how do I please you so much, you tell her? And it's that hand-to-hand shift that makes things work. So my new book is What to Do When It's Your Turn. I published it myself and only told people about it on my blog. So I have a lot of people read my blog, a lot of people bought it the first day. But you couldn't buy one. You either had to buy 2, 3, 5, or 12. So a lot of people bought 5. Well, what do you do if you get 5? You have to give 4 away. So it's been fascinating to watch since November. People who I have permission to talk to are busy giving it to people who have never heard of me. So I'm not trying to yell at strangers. I'm trying to serve the people who already trust me. And I checked last week, and for every order I get that's a new order, I get 11 reorders. Which has never happened in the history of book publishing, ever. that 11 people who already bought a copy come back and buy more because they are using it now to advance their agenda, which is training people around them. That is the next frontier. Not how do I get more strangers, how do I get the people who like me to tell their friends. Anyway, I have 9 seconds left, so I'll just say goodbye. Good luck. The work you do really matters. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Seth Godin, everybody. You're
the best. Awesome.
No.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Diana Thompson,
by the way. I have someone from the Brazil team that wanted to say hello to you briefly. You don't have to do this.